Musings on a number of current issues. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Well, it's good to see you. Having survived the funky weather, we're recording this on Tuesday, and many of us had interesting weather on Monday night. Me being one of them, my front screen door was caught in the wind, and it was a nice, heavy Larson door, and the internal skeleton got broken by smashing up against back and forth against the wall and against the door frame. So
we're starting a GoFundMe for Chuck's door.
Yeah. Well, actually, having priced doors, I may need a GoFundMe for that.
Well, but, you know, hopefully, Chuck, that's all the damage that you sustained from the storms that blew through. And thankfully, we weren't nearly as hard hit as those folks in the Plains and in Texas.
No.
who really, I feel for. You know, that's part of the reason I like living in Ohio is that we rarely get those kind of significant weather events. The biggest thing we get is high pollen counts and maybe some awfully drippy summer weather when the humidity gets up there. But and again, we do. You know, everybody remembers the tornado in Xenia in the 70s and all those things. But you know, we're overall pretty blessed to live in this state, to have the, shall we say, average life that we have weather-wise in Ohio.
Well, think about it. The Xenia tornado is over 40 years ago.
Yes, it is. That doesn't mean we're due for another one.
No.
That just means that really don't have that much severe. Now, if you go and you flip on any television or radio that's near you around one of these events, it seems like weekly we're having the cataclysmic apocalyptic storm of the century.
Yeah, right.
That will totally wipe off the face of the earth a civilization as we know it.
And if you listen to these guys talk, what's fun is when those sirens start going, they put the weather guy up front and center on the, you know, on the news channels, on the locals. And my gosh, those poor guys, they basically say talk.
Yes.
And talk they do.
And they do.
And you get stuff that some of it's good, some of it not so good, and a lot of it is just like filler. And of course, they got to send the chase teams out. And these poor schmucks are in these vans out, you know, driving around to get pictures of damage. Well, thank you. We can look outside and see plenty of damage. I don't need to see that a tree was down. I had to laugh. There was a local thing here in Columbus. There was a tree that came down on a house in German Village. Oh, my gosh. We went on and on and on and on and on and on about this tree that came down, and they took pictures of it. It has ivy growing up on the outside, which means it's a sick tree, and maybe the ivy caused the tree to be sick, and the owner had been in negotiations with the city to have the tree removed and another tree removed, and I'm like, well, I know here in Westerville, if you got a tree that needs to be removed, guess who gets to do it?
You get to do it.
And
you get to pay for it.
That's right. If the city does it, they charge you top dollar to have that tree removed. So basically, you know, we went on and on and on and back and forth and you know, wasted all this time on this dumb tree that came down. You know, I feel sorry for the guy in German Village that the tree came down on his house. But if you didn't want the tree to come down on your house and you knew it was sick, you should have called somebody to come take your tree down.
Yeah, it's much cheaper to have somebody cut your tree down than to have God push it over in a windstorm.
On your roof, yeah. On your 150-year-old house with a slate roof.
Yeah,
good
exactly.
Luck. You're going to have fun replacing that.
Well, you know, that's the way it works sometimes. But, you know, when we get right around to it, Charles, there are certain things that we can't control. We cannot control the weather. We cannot control the path of the weather. And unlike those who in our culture believe that they can control everything, we realize that there are certain things that God has put in place that we really just cannot mess with. And, you know, and we're going to be talking about a couple of those things today when we talk about natural marriage, which is, you know, one of those things. And we also talk about our basic faith belief, our basic religion. And I think you had been looking at an interesting poll that has just recently come out that, just like our news, TV and radio news forecasters, every time we get a heavy dew or the chance of precipitation, they've turned it into the apocalyptic event of the century. It seems like every time that we get a poll that comes out now, Charles, on Americans' attitudes toward fill in the blank, whatever the issue is, it's always touted as this major sea change or a major turning point in all of culture. And I think this poll is no exception to that. I actually, matter of fact, think that this is probably a good example of that hyperbolic viewpoint that coming out there. Because the headline of the article, and this is coming from the Pew Research Center. Now, Pew is a quote-unquote venerable public opinion research organization. Venerable means they've just been around a long time. It doesn't mean that they've been completely accurate. It doesn't mean that they actually do good polling. And as we look at this poll, we'll dig into it a little bit more and show you where they sometimes don't do good polling by how they structure questions. But the headline, and this is coming out on May the 12th, which is the day we're taping this, headline, America's Changing Religious Landscape, in big, bold, black letters.
Naturally, yeah.
And then underneath of it, the bumper line, Christians decline sharply as share of population, unaffiliated and other faiths continue to grow. Now, Chuck, you and I have probably seen at least three or four different articles today already for major news feeds saying basically roughly Christianity is in decline. It is in, you know, it's heading toward its the twilight of its years. And it's written that this poll is, you know, proof positive that people are rejecting Christianity in droves. But you and I are a little bit less, shall we say, swayed by these popular opinions and swayed by these trend lines, and we tend to dig a little bit deeper.
Well, okay. You and I are both more or less trained, in many ways self-trained. And by the way, this is something you can do for yourself. They're out there in radio land and podcast land. We're trained in a little bit of critical thought. And by critical, we don't mean, ooh, your eyes are all watery and your belly's hanging over your belt. And that's not, yeah. And you stick out your tongue. That's right. And that's not what we mean by critical thought. Critical thought means basically looking at what is written or said or on television or name some kind of media presentation and looking at it and saying, okay, what is behind this? What is the author or the artist or the writer or whoever trying to say? And what is the worldview behind it? And what techniques are they using to get their message across? That's critical thought. You'll often hear in the Bible, higher criticism. Higher criticism is not sitting around going, well, the Bible's junk. It's a man-made document. No, criticism is looking at texts and saying, which of these are, how do we weight this text when we look at another text of the same part of the Bible? How do we assign it a value? And how do we get that into the Bible translation? That's critical thinking about text, and that's what we're trying to do here. Now, one of the things we've got coming up to do a little bit of self-promotion is Camp American. And one thing we do there is teach people young and old how to do critical thinking. It's not a skill that you develop overnight, but it is a skill that you can develop over time. And it's a skill that you have to have a kind of a starting place and the places to look, where to go, how to do these things. And one of the classes that I'm teaching is a class called Tuning Up Your Baloney Detector. And a baloney detector is basically a critical thinking toolkit. So if you want to learn more about critical thinking, please come up to Camp American. Come on up, volunteer, sign up as a student. Obviously, the students that are like 12 and up are going to have a different time of it than the students who are over 30. You're not going to engage in some of the games, and you're not going to engage in some of the fun stuff. But you'll still have fun. You'll still get to go boating and, you know, do all the water sports and the putt-putt and all the other stuff. But you won't be doing it for cabin points. But that being said, one of the things we'd like you to do is learn how to do critical thinking. So that's why we do this program, and that's why we look at articles like this, so we can teach you how to delve more deeply into the things you read and see what's bunk and what's true, and whether the headlines actually match the data, which is something we're going to be examining today.
Indeed. Well, Chuck, you know, as you're talking about this whole critical thinking part and digging in, and while you're talking about that, I'm sitting here on Pew's website digging into their top line data and the actual questionnaires to figure out what exactly they've been asking people, and we'll get to that in a little bit, but I think that it's somewhat educational to find out how they ask questions. Because sometimes how you ask a question, how you frame a question, or how you then ask sub-questions after the response to the initial question oftentimes shade the outcome, because it's called leading the witness in legal terms. You start asking them pointed questions to kind of get them over into a box so that you can mark them in a box. And I think those boxes are important, Charles, because oftentimes when you blow up and come up above the top line data to these headline data, which is what we get in most of the news articles, because very few of them ever go into top line data or into the specific questions in the questionnaire and start breaking that down, what you end up with is that headline data, which makes the big splash, which helps drive the apocalyptic meme, as I'm going to use this weather theme that we've got going, and will ultimately be used more as a propaganda tool rather than a reporting tool to assess what's actually happening in the culture. Now, I will give Pew credit for a couple things, Chuck. First and foremost, the nature of this poll is not what we call a drive-by poll. This is not one that was commissioned and then, like, in the space of 24 hours, they made about 300 or 400 phone calls to a predetermined list,
right,
and then came out with all this data that you're supposed to bank on. They really did do some significant work in this poll. This poll was out there, I believe, for about a month and a half. And according to their top line data, which I'm going to open this up again, their number of folks that they had in their sample was 34,891 answering their questionnaire. That's pretty significant.
That's a large sampling.
I will give Pew an awful lot of credit for that. They actually, I said a few weeks. It was more like 3 months. They went from June the 4th to September the 30th of last year. They totaled 35,071 calls to people. So some didn't answer, some didn't respond, but they did, and they asked numerous questions. And we'll get into the questions in a minute. But I want to give them some credit first. That is a very thorough job of polling.
Barry, that's 1% of the population of the United States of America.
That's right.
That's a big sample.
It is a very big sample, and it's a sample that you could probably say with, I'm looking through here to find out what they say that their accuracy on this poll. Usually they tell
you. They'll give
you
a plus or minus.
It's plus or minus so many percentages at the such and such, you know, confidence level. And I'm trying to find that in here. And it's funny that they really don't even say this up front in their polling. This is on Pew's website. So as we go through here, I'll scroll down because this is a long article about this this poll and the positions that they've taken on this. They've done a lot of work here, Chuck. First of all, I want to make sure that nobody thinks that we're just dismissing anything like this offhand, because really, this took some doing.
Well, here's the thing that you need to understand about sampling size. Sampling size really adds to the accuracy of your poll as long as it's truly a random poll.
Right.
If it's you can gauge 1% of the population in the United States, and you can cherry pick 1% of the population and skew your numbers. But if you're getting a true random sampling, 1% is a big, you know, when you figure 315 million people, that's a big sample.
Yes, it is. It's a very big sample. And so what they started asking were questions about what your religious beliefs are. And they asked numerous questions. And we're not going to go, I mean, we could be sitting here for all afternoon talking about all the specific questions that they got into. But really, their headline data that they put out is that between 2007, which is when the last time they did one of these large polls, and 2014, which is the next one, they measured changes in percentages of people who identify as various faiths. And their top line says that between those two dates, between 2007 and 2014, the Christian share of the population fell from 78.4% to 70.6%, driven mainly by declines among mainline Protestants and Catholics. Now, hear me carefully.
Yes.
Mainline Protestants and Catholics. And it's true, because they have a little data graphic here on their website, and we'll put this up on our website, that basically shows that when you got into mainline Protestants, that was probably the biggest subgroup of religion that had the biggest decline, of 3.4 percentage points of people who identified as a mainline Protestant. Now, Catholic faith didn't fare too well either. They had a drop of 3.1 percentage point change from 23.9% to 20.8% of people who would consider themselves to be Catholic. Now, the smallest drop was among evangelical Protestants, whose numbers only went down 0.9%, Charles. So from 26.3% to 25.4% of those who identified as, in their survey, identified as evangelical Protestants. So that means that as a single group, Charles, evangelical Protestants was the largest individual religious expression group that Pew surveyed in this poll. I think that's something that we need to say, take some time to think about
that's
here.
Significant. Now, by it the is way, the error margin of error in the
oh, good, you found it before I did.
0.6%, plus or minus.
Plus or minus 0.6.
Yeah.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, usually the vast majority of polls out there pat themselves on the back if they're plus or minus less than 4%, and consider it to be a really good and solid poll if they're in the neighborhood of 3.2% or less. A 0.6 is almost saying we can go to the bank with these numbers.
Yeah, that's true. And it has to do with the way, if you read the part, okay.
Does it say at which confidence level that 0.6
is?
No.
Usually
the way those are measured, at the 95% confidence,
right?
Which means, you know, you've got 95% chance of, you know, you can
falling
take this
into
to
that
bank.
Range,
yeah,
plus
right.
or minus 0.6. Basically, they're claiming that it's based on the size of their sample.
Well, that's a big part of it, yes.
Which is correct.
Yeah.
The larger the size of your sample, the more narrow range is your 95% confidence level.
Yep.
And the more
likely you are to not have an error in how you sorted the data.
Exactly. And it's on the Appendix A, the methodology section.
Uh-huh.
And they actually talk about how they designed the samples, how they did the interviewing, some minutiae, even weighting, how they weighted the gender by age, gender by education level.
Sure.
Education level by age.
In other words, this was a significant undertaking.
This was not a Gallup calling 400 people inside metropolitan area New York and then coming up with a national average based on that.
On a Thursday night and then deciding that that was what everybody was doing on Sunday.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So these numbers are a lot stronger. But if you just read the headline stuff, Chuck, Christians decline sharply. Well, that's really not true. Evangelical Protestants are still over 25% of the population by self-identification. Their change was only less than 1% change overall. And if you really want to say that that's a big decline, I'm not sure you can say that. But what they are finding is that those other big drops in Catholics and mainline Protestants and the other categories that are actually showing increases, Charles, and the biggest increase in their survey between 07 and 14 was among those who would consider themselves to be unaffiliated with any particular religious expression. That has risen dramatically from a 16.1% of the population back in 2007 to 22.8% of the population today. And also non-Christian faiths are increasing overall. Now, and that one too, Chuck, is a kind of a misnomer, because when you say non-Christian faiths, and oh, they're growing from 4.7 to 5.9%, in other words, it's a 1.2% increase over those 7 years, you're not just talking about, you know, one subset of Christian faith. That non-Christian faith category includes Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, other world religion, and other faiths. Read non-Christian pagan religions.
Right, right, yeah. So you could come up with a long list as long as your arm of religions with 18 people in it.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting who doesn't get shown in this data. It says that those who did not answer the religious identity question, which, as we showed earlier, there were a lot who did answer that, as well as groups whose share of the population did not change significantly, including the historically black Protestant tradition, Mormons, and others, are not shown. So in other words, well, if you take those out of the mix, because they didn't change significantly, I can see that they say that they would have no impact on the numbers. But even so, I think you might say that really our percentages are still pretty solid. And why would you take historically black Protestant tradition out of the mix? Would that change evangelical Protestant numbers? Would that make those a little stronger? You know, what's a significant change in that? So you have to think about those things. But what they're trying to say, or at least what the pundits are saying, and of course, if you go like to Yahoo News, headline, poll shows those in U.S. drifting away from religion.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's go back to Pew. Okay, let's look at those numbers again. Evangelical Protestants are 25.4% of the population. Catholics are 20.8%, and mainline Protestants are 14.7% of the population, which, if you do, that's 60.9% of the population, Charles, would fall under a Protestant or Catholic, whether mainline or evangelical, heading, versus 22.8% of the population that would be considered unaffiliated. Now, with them, unaffiliated also includes atheists and agnostics. Now, and that's where I wanted to have a little quick chat about poll questionnaires and methodology. Because really, when you get right down to it, when they started asking the questions, one of the ways they sorted the questions out, and I'm looking at their top line data now, it says, here's the question. This was question E1. What is your present religion, if any? Are you Protestant, Roman Catholic, Mormon, Orthodox, such as Greek or Russian Orthodox, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, atheist, agnostic, something else or nothing in particular? Wait a minute. Whoa. Let's back up here for a second. What is your present religion? Atheist, agnostic? Chuck, according to atheists and agnostics, that's not religion. They don't have a religion.
Yeah, right. You, So you're opening up the can of worms of allowing a category error.
Category error starting to creep in here.
Yeah,
that's right.
Again, folks, that's one of those that is one of those logical fallacy issues.
Uh-huh.
A category error. You think about it in these terms. My neighbors have an animal next door. It's covered with fur. It has four legs.
It's a tiger.
Yeah, it's covered with fur. It has four legs, and it growls at squirrels and other small animals that run across the yard.
It's a tiger. Okay, I get now, that.
Therefore, a lot of people would assume it's on four legs, has a tail, it's covered with fur.
Uh-huh.
It's a dog because it chases squirrels and rabbits. It's a cat.
It's a cat.
So,
see, I told you it was a tiger.
If I give you a partial description, it's covered with fur, has four legs, growls, and chases rabbits and squirrels, it's an ambiguous question. Therefore, you might make a category error and say, well, okay, we'll count that as a dog, when in fact it's a cat. That is a typical category error. Well, we're going to count all those as dogs. Everything that growls, has four legs, is covered with fur, and has a tail.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's a dog. Well, it's a cat. And I have heard the cat growl at rabbits and squirrels. Nonetheless.
Yes.
That is the kind of thing that can happen. While you're talking,
yes,
I'm busily searching for what the comparison data is that they used to say that there was a drop.
Exactly. The comparison data was a similar poll that they conducted in 2007, but they didn't ask the specific questions deeply into what religious expression these people had.
And that's one of the problems. You've yes. got, what you have is an apples and oranges comparison. And again, apples and oranges, when you hear the term apples and oranges, they're looking for a category error. You don't necessarily have a category error, but you do have a sampling error.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you didn't gear your study to look for exactly the same kind of data, you're comparing two sets of data that may not really be where you thought the original study was.
That's true.
So these drops might not be as sharp.
That's true. They may very well not be. Now, again, they asked that question, so we got this category error started. But also, if the respondent would say nothing in particular or no religion, they were to prompt them again with, and would you say that's atheist, agnostic, or just nothing in particular? Well, wait a minute. You've just identified it as which is your present religion, and added atheist and agnostic in. But when they say none in particular, i.e. eliminating those two, you go back around and prompt them to possibly pick one of those two, atheist or agnostic. That's a little bit of leading, I think. I think it may be okay in the realm of data collection.
Well, here's the problem you've got. Because the way a lot of agnostics define themselves, nothing in particular is an agnostic position.
Mm-hmm.
Atheist is dead certain that there is no God. An agnostic, although a functional atheist, is sitting there saying, well, I don't have enough data one way or another, which is a way of saying nothing in particular. So yes. you essentially have two categories that are virtually the same thing. Nothing in particular and agnostic. So an agnostic would tend to place himself in a place that he would think would bring him the most cachet with the interviewer.
Oh, very well could. Yeah, that bias is in there. And then he goes into they keep going into these questions as well. So you get this one. This is that clarification to get them into saying, but if they say a non-Christian religion, Charles, i.e. Native American religion, Wiccan, pagan, etc.
Right.
You just enter a no on the code and don't read the question to them. In other words, you don't try to push them. But the question is, do you think of yourself as a Christian or not? So even if they answered atheist or agnostic, they could be an atheist or agnostic Christian. So I think that gets into that overwhelmingly large change in the religiously unaffiliated that they're pushing for. And then, of course, they go and they ask you, you know, if you're as far as your religion, if you're Protestant or Christian unspecified, they ask you about your denomination or your church, and the prompt is to the respondent that you're to read them in order and then basically just stop me when I get to the right one. Now, okay, Chuck, I'm going to have you do this, okay? Now, you're not looking at this, right?
No.
You're not looking at this question. Okay. I'm going to do this. I'll be the interviewer. You'll be the respondent. You stop me when I get to the right one. Okay, so the question is, as far as your present religion, what denomination or church, if any, do you identify with most closely? Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian.
Bingo.
Let me keep going. Pentecostal, Episcopalian, Church of Christ, Congregationalist, Holiness, Reformed. Church of God, non-denominational or independent church, or something else.
Yeah, see, Reformed Church?
Yeah.
What kind? Dutch Reformed?
Well, well, it includes the Reformed Church in America and Christian Reformed, but there are many who would consider themselves Reformed Presbyterians.
And there are many Presbyterians who don't consider themselves Reformed. Yeah.
So, you know, you and I can speak to that because we're both in the Reformed tradition and are both Presbyterians of slightly different stripes. But but there you go, Chuck. And that's the reason why I wanted to test this question out. You did exactly what most respondents would do. As soon as you heard one that was close, you stopped them.
You hit my denomination.
I hit your denomination.
And see, that's kind of – now, to give them the benefit of the doubt, that's what they're trying to do.
Yes.
When they say Reformed, they mean a different thing than when you and I say Reformed.
That's right. It's
big R Reformed, not small R Reformed.
Right. So what they're really getting at is they're not really interested in your religion. They're interested in
your denomination.
Your denomination. They're interested in your governing structure because Presbyterianism is a governing structure.
Exactly.
So is Baptist, so is Lutheran, so is Methodist. Those are all governing structures.
And so is Congregationalist.
But your religion is either Reformed or Arminian, Anabaptist. You can go down the list.
Roman Catholic.
Those are religions, not just government forms.
Yeah, Roman Catholic, Orthodox. Now, see, here's an issue that comes up. I'm a member of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church.
Yes.
So when somebody says Orthodox, hey.
Yeah, that's you. You're
that's
there.
That's me. I'm Orthodox Presbyterian. Now, see, you're American because you're in the Presbyterian Church in America.
That's right.
Therefore, so if somebody says American, you bet. I'm the member of the American religion.
That's right.
There are issues with this.
Sure.
I'm looking at how they did their comparison data.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not impressed with the numbers they used to compare against. I'll be quite honest.
No, I mean, and honestly, you know, when you have 7-year-old data, it's going to be a little difficult, but you can work. They spent enough time on this that they could have worked to do to structure the question similarly to what they did in 2007. Now, my guess is they've structured these questions differently in 2014 because they had someone who was investing some resources who was interested in finding out some particular data points. Because you can do that with surveys.
Any
survey company, you can it's called it's not a free rider, but it's like a free rider. If you know they're going to go out with a poll, you can throw them some money and say, hey, can you ask these couple of questions to the same polling group? And we want to see that data.
Well, let me ask you a question, Barry. How many times have I called you up? What's one of my favorite hobbies here when I get a survey phone call?
Tormenting the surveyor.
Tormenting the surveyor. I'll be quite honest. I have a blast because, A, I do answer honestly.
Yes, you do.
And I can tell when I'm not fitting the mold. Because the surveyor will be like, but you said this. And I'm like, yeah, I did say that. And I said, there's no contradiction between what I said here and what I said here. But. And I'm like, there's not. People who know what polling's about can make a pollster's life very difficult.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Because they expect you to fit in a category, and when you don't fit in a category, it makes them a little insane. In fact, they very often, I wouldn't be surprised if the way I do things gets me thrown out as a sample.
Well, very well could. They usually throw out the outliers, and I'd say you're about an outlier.
I'm usually an outlier. but I have a blast because, Barry, you and I also both know that polls can very often have an endpoint in mind. It's called a push poll.
That's true.
You ask a question in order to get a preconceived outcome. And I've learned how to recognize these. I'm not saying that this study is there because I don't think it is. However, there is some built-in bias in this study. And we just showed you one. Atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular.
Exactly.
That is a built-in bias.
Yes, it is. Very much so. But, you know, Chuck, but again, as we're drilling into this poll, we can see where there are issues with it. But again, here we have, like I said, if you go out to the poll, or you go out to the mainstream media, which is where most people go to,
right,
very few people are going to go over and sit on Pew Research's website digging into the report materials, either the complete report, the appendices of the tables and everything else, the questionnaires, etc. They're just going to look at the top line. They're just, or the what I call the headline data. And that's what, when you go over to the news media where everybody else is looking, you're going to get certain particular, biases that are showing up. Like this bias from Yahoo News. Well, Yahoo is a major news aggregator that a lot of people go to. I mean, it's basically on half of your smartphones right now.
And I will tell you that it's an extremely biased news aggregator.
That's the point I'm making, is that it is extremely much a bias, because poll shows those in U.S. drifting away from religion is the top line headline. And it says the share of U.S. residents who identify as Christians has shrunk over the past 7 years, while adults unaffiliated with organized religion, now that's not necessarily true, now represent a larger portion of the public, a poll released on Tuesday found. Okay, now if you just stopped right there and that was the cutaway that you had, like that was the teaser going into, you know, the commercial coming back to the story, and you couldn't come back to the story, what impression are you left with?
Yep.
You're left with the impression that Christianity is in decline and people are turning away from the church in droves. And, you know, they keep pushing this whole idea, you know, that it's fallen, driven mainly by drops among Roman Catholics and some Protestants, according to the Pew Research Center poll. Non-religious U.S. adults who identify, and they roll them back in, atheists, agnostics, or of no particular faith, have seen their ranks swell over that same time period by 6 percentage points to 56 million people. Well, that's kind of hard to determine, just as it's hard to determine that there's 172.8 million people who are Protestant and Catholic in this country. And then they just keep going this whole idea is right here. Okay. One of the most important factors is in the declining share of Christians and the growth of the nuns is generational replacement, referring to respondents who chose no religious identity. As the millennial generation enters adulthood, its members display much lower levels of religious affiliation. Well, Charles, not to take too much umbrage with this poll, but that's not what I'm seeing among many young people today. I mean, I run around in government circles. You know that,
Charles. Right.
You would be, I think our listeners would be shocked at about the number of people wandering around the state house who are engaged in Bible studies, prayer groups, or who self-identify as Christians, both as members of the legislature, staff, agency people, lobbyists. Chuck, about every other Wednesday, there's a pastor here from Westerville who goes down to the state house and holds a Bible study at midday for the staff and the lobbyists of the legislature to do a Bible study. And it's usually well attended. Everybody from the security people to the lobbyists to aides at the legislature, and then the members themselves hold their own Bible studies and prayer groups in the mornings. There is an awful lot of religion, and oftentimes many of the people around those tables are the millennial generation. It's the younger folks. It isn't the guys with gray in their hair and their beard like me. It's more of, although I'm there every once in a while, it's more of the younger set, you know, who are talking about the churches that they're going to and why they're going to church. Young people really are, in many instances, now maybe their faith expression is a little less solidly defined.
And their doctrine is probably not as firmly defined.
Yeah, maybe not. But the point is that that's not that they're not going to church or having a religious affiliation. It's just that, as we're seeing, they're not self-identifying mainline Protestant or Catholic as much as they used to.
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. Now, I'm just before I go on with that, I've been perusing Yahoo.
Okay.
That story's all but fallen off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm way down the page, and for some reason, it's really not around anymore. Now, why would that be? Well, there are a number of reasons things fall off Yahoo, but usually it's because the intended effect
didn't take place.
Didn't take place.
That's right.
And so they, and let's not kid ourselves, Yahoo is a propaganda tool.
Mm-hmm.
If the propaganda isn't working, you either rework it into something else. And believe me, I have personally gone to Yahoo, read a headline, and then read the story and found out that basically Yahoo got everything completely wrong, including the conclusion they reached when they wrote the headline and commented on their section and gone back later in the day. And not only is the story completely different, the headline is completely different because they know that when they've been called out on it. Well, rather than maybe back away, they just basically, okay, we've had all the effect we're going to have with that, and it's gone away.
Mm-hmm.
It may show up again in a couple of days. Who knows? Very often these things show up here and there in another place. But that's part of what's wrong with some of these studies. Because Pew, I have an idea, knew that, but they egged it on with these, you know, using numbers like plunge, some of these headline-generating headlines on their own website. Well, why do you do that? Well, let's face it. When you're a company like Pew Research, you've got to get a little advertising, a little mm-hmm. marketing when you can. And the way to do it is to talk about this study that's got shows these giant margins that really aren't all that giant.
Yeah.
Is it a disturbing trend? Yeah, I think so. I think I'm a little disturbed by it. Am I surprised by the fact that the biggest gainers are agnostics and atheists? My gosh, no. When was the last time anybody attended a college class or talked to your children about what's going on in their college classes? My gosh. Atheism, basically, students are not only discouraged from talking about their faith,
mm-hmm.
they are actively being told that you're not allowed to talk about your faith in this class. Well, so much for freedom of speech and,
yes.
and freedom of religion. And unfortunately, Barry, most of these places are taxpayer funded.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So, why are we seeing young people who are feeling a little different about these things than possibly we're being told? Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, God chooses who he chooses.
Yes, he does.
And people come in spite of themselves. I realize that will be an unpopular thing among certain circles. That's part of the idea of the Reformed faith. that God chooses who he will choose. And do we choose him? Yes, we do. But we choose him after he makes us capable of choosing him. So that's the whole point. He makes people capable of choosing him. And is their doctrine as sound as it should be? Well, my doctrine wasn't as sound as it should be when I was in my 20s. Yeah,
true, exactly.
I've gone through all kinds of doctrinal things. So what this partly is gauging is that people's doctrines sometimes change.
True.
And people's affiliations with denominations change. I, at one point, was a Baptist. At another point, I was a Nazarene, and now I'm a Presbyterian. I've been a Southern Baptist. I was baptized an Episcopalian as an infant. I was a Lutheran from the time I was about 10, and I was Reformed Anglican Orthodox from the time I was about 12 until my parents stopped going to church when I was about 15. So I've been all over the place. And once I became mature, I became an Orthodox Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the journey that a lot of these people are going to go through.
Oh, it is. It is. Now, I think one of the things that this survey brings out, Charles, is that, this whole idea of people switching religions and things of that nature, that basically it says that if all Protestants, and I'm reading from the report, if all Protestants were treated as a single religious group, then fully 34% of American adults currently have a religious identity different from the one in which they were raised, which you just referenced there. That's up 6 points since 2007. If switching among the three Protestant traditions from mainline to evangelical or from evangelical to historically black Protestant denomination is added to the total, then the share of Americans who currently have a different religion than they did in childhood rises to 42%. Now, but it says that by a wide margin, religious nuns have experienced larger gains through religious switching than any other group. Okay, so I think it's getting to what our point is.
Right.
Nearly one in five U.S. adults were raised in a religious faith and now identify with no religion. Some switching also has occurred in the other direction. 9% of American adults said they were raised with no religious affiliation, and almost half of them now identify with some religion. But for every person who's joined a religion after having been raised unaffiliated, there are more than four people who have become religious nuns after being raised in some religion. And so what they're really talking, this is that more than 85% of American adults were raised Christian, but nearly a quarter of those who were raised Christian no longer identify with Christianity. Chuck, I wanted to grab that little piece.
That doesn't skew with the numbers.
It does not. I wanted to grab that little piece, Chuck, because what I think is there's a little bit of begging, and there's another article that you sent over to me that we were going to talk about today, and I think it kind of works in this particular. It makes it more understandable what's going on with this particular meme. And this is something coming from over in the Aquila Report. And it's an article written by Elise Hilton over the weekend. And the headline says, "It's come to this, having good parents is an," quote, "unfair advantage," yeah, unquote. So basically, the family it does not allow for a level playing field in our society. And so, therefore, we have to abandon this idea of having a stable family. Well, Chuck, that's kind of like the folks who grow up in religious homes deciding to cast off their faith belief. And I think that kind of adds into this, that, you know, they're talking about this whole idea that we have a theme, a meme, as we like to call it, in our society right now, that if you grew up with an intact family, two parents who actually were engaged in your life in some way, shape, or form, then you are unfairly advantaged in society. In other words, we have to do something to level the playing field, because that's not fair to everybody else that you had good parents and thus have better, possibly better education, better outcomes, etc.
This was one of the scariest statements I think I'd ever heard.
Uh-huh.
It's an unfair advantage for you to be good parents.
Yep.
Unfair advantage. Well, who sets the boundary? Who defines fairness? The fact is, Barry, this is radical egalitarianism run amok. And by that I mean the following. It says that equality of outcome is more important than equality of opportunity.
Yes.
Everyone has an equal opportunity, at least in this country, of having those advantages. There are parents who choose not to take those advantages for their own set of reasons. And suddenly we have to basically have philosophers, and the guy who said this was a
philosopher, yes.
In quotes, I'll put that.
And this is how the article where they pulled his quotes from described him. The philosopher's name is Adam Swift. And he has been called a, quote, liberal egalitarian sociologist with an interest in social justice. A surprise.
Three strikes, you're out.
What a surprise. but what it really gets down to is this Swift individual, this philosopher, sociologist, has made a few statements that along these lines. Now, these are quotes from this that were run on ABC. And he was quoted as saying, one way philosophers might think about solving the social justice problem, and that should stop you right there, the social justice problem,
right,
would be by simply abolishing the family. Remember we were talking about that thing about there are certain things in life you can't change because God has instituted them,
yes,
like the wind and the weather? How about the family?
Okay. Look, Barry, this
you can't abolish the family. It's one of God's institutions, and he's not going to sit quietly for you doing it.
This is one of those things that revolutionaries have been trying to do for eons. They
yes,
always
is.
Want to upset the natural order. And wasn't that something you brought about? You talked about natural religion and the natural order.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the natural order, and by that we mean the things that get talked about in Romans 1. It's one of those things that God has ordained that the fool looks at and says, we're not going to do that.
Right.
We're going to do something. We're going to rebuild society based on something we want it to be, not on something it is.
Exactly. And Swift goes on to say that if the family is this source of unfairness in society, then it looks plausible to think that if we abolished the family, there would be a more level playing field. And he says we should accept that lots of stuff that goes on in healthy families and that our theory defends will confer unfair advantage. Now, again, so he's saying that really he's not saying you should stop reading to your kids at bedtime. You just should feel guilty about it. How dare you? When there are so many kids who are going to bed without having bedtime stories read to them, you should feel guilty about reading to your own kids.
Well, not only that. How dare you help your kids with their homework? How dare you demand that they excel in their classwork? How dare you demand that they apply themselves to their work and have a good outcome, the best outcome they can possibly do with their particular skill set? This is much wider than just reading to them.
Mm-hmm.
What it is instilling in them the things that God has told you to educate them in.
That's right.
And that would include exactly what we've just talked about, and that is good religious doctrine. Which is, when you think about it, is part and parcel. You know, people want to subtract out the idea that academics shouldn't include training in religious faith. Those are entirely different things. No, those are part and parcel of one another.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that people, agnostics and atheists, can't have excellent academics? No, we can see that. There are lots of atheists who are great at the academic part, but they are a pluperfect mess when it comes to the spiritual part of their life. So this is, well, let's, when I first saw this thing, I'm like, is this from The Onion?
No, afraid not.
And the author of this piece basically says, one of my co-workers thought he was reading an article from the satirical website The Onion. I mean, that's the same thing that came to my mind when I first saw it. I thought, this has to be from The Onion. But he says, alas, this is not the case.
Not the case, that's right.
So, you know, the wow. I mean, he's going so far as to say it's a bad thing to go out and throw the baseball with your son, or kick the soccer ball around with your daughter, or, you know, whatever. Be engaged in your children's lives at all, because there are people who don't do that, and therefore you must not do that too to make society equal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really unbelievably silly. So how do you combat thinking like this? I mean, this man is using probably taxpayer dollars to come up with this garbage. And there will be people who defend the idea that it's academic freedom.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the author of this article goes to Daniel Greenfield at Front Page Magazine, who did kind of an expose on this Swift, and laughing about it, basically saying, and Greenfield's quotes were, "I've come to the conclusion that the West is unfairly advantaged by having so many sociologists, critical race theorists, and social justice warriors. If we all deported them to poor countries, they could finally catch up to us in the field of social justice."
Parts of Asia and Africa could definitely use some more of those. Let's export.
Yeah.
Use that particular export.
Well, Greenberg goes on, he says, "As much as it might pain us to lose these demented parasites, I mean, respected academics, it's the right thing to do. No longer will we enjoy our vast advantages in sociology and theories on gendered icebergs." Yes, it's a thing. "The rest of the world will now be able to benefit from having a declining economy and an academic environment that consists of crazy people denouncing others for thought crimes." I think he's on to something.
Well, quite honest about there's Charles. A little tongue-in-cheek in this article, but like all satire, it has a bite that goes to the truth.
Yes, it does.
All good satire. There's bad satire out there that doesn't really do anything. But I like the part where he crossed out demented. He put in the words demented something or academics
and
crossed
yeah.
it out. Demented parasites. Yeah. Is this the question then? Is this a legitimate viewpoint? That's the real question you have to ask. Again, this goes back to your critical thinking skills. Is this a legitimate viewpoint, Barry? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think it's an absurdity, and maybe he's attempting to highlight absurdity by being absurd. I don't think so. I think he really believes this.
Yes, I do believe that he really believes that this is one of the ways that we can somehow assuage our battered consciences in the face of so much. And remember, all bad things that happen are a result of religion, Chuck. But all the good things that happen are a result of sociology.
Which is a patent absurdity on its face. I'm almost left speechless by this kind of just radical nonsense, and that anyone would give this guy any form of respectability.
Well, and see, that's the whole point, Chuck. We would have said this years ago about Peter Singer. And back 100 years ago, they would have said this about Margaret Sanger.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
But that's the problem. When these ideas and these ideologies first come out, they sound absurd. But the more traction they get in academia, then the more people start getting numb to them and then start thinking, well, maybe they're onto something.
And that's it. You become numb to it when you're in college. You have to write a paper on this. You have to do research on this. Here's the sources I want you to use, and I will reject your more spiritual sources. I will only take these sources, especially in a sociology course, which is why I always laugh when people tell me sociology is a science.
Mm-hmm.
No, it is not.
No.
Okay, that's it. We are out of time for this week. We would ask that, you go out to principledpolicy.com, take a look at our website. We have some writings out there. This will be posted out there as a podcast. And also go to campamerican.com. That's campamerican.com. And sign up for camp this year. Come out and learn some critical thinking skills. That being said, join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.